Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the world of business, there are people who are usually great leaders or great marketers, great innovators, or great creative engineering inventor types. But seldom does a single individual possess two or more of those traits. Rarer still is someone who possesses all four. And by all accounts, the late Steve Jobs of Apple did. Since his death in 2011, biographers have described him alternately either as an intemperate genius or an unapproachable iconoclast. But for his family, coworkers, and friends, this portrayal was shallow and more accurately portrayed his youth rather than as the mature leader of the largest market capitalized company in the world. My guest today is co-author of a new biography of Jobs that chronicles his beginnings at Apple, his fall from his first stint as CEO, his travails at Next, his acquisition of Pixar, and of course his legendary turnaround of Apple during his second stint as CEO. The book depicts him as a man who wrestled with his failings and eventually learned to maximize his strengths. Becoming Steve Jobs, the evolution of a reckless upstart into a visionary leader, is the work of journalist Brett Schlender, who covered Jobs for the Wall Street Journal and Fortune magazine for nearly 25 years and was as close as a journalist could get to this legendary CEO, and his editor, Rick Tetzeli, who is currently executive editor of Fast Company and a former deputy editor at Fortune. Rick Tetzeli joins us today to talk about their new book, Becoming Steve Jobs, here on Studio Tulsa. Rick Tetzeli, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Tell us about the decision to write this book, Becoming Steve Jobs. Since Steve Jobs' death in 2011, most notably Walter Isaacson has written about him. There have been several books about him. But I gather from what you've written that it's been criticized by those that knew him best as one-sided or taking his early years as sort of the grounds for his entire life. And the people who knew him best said that was pretty unfair. Why did you and Brent decide to write this book?
Well, that was, you know, that's not our take on the Isaacson book. That's the take of people who were close to Steve. You know, we decided to write our book totally independent of the Isaacson biography because my co-writer, Brent Schlender, knew Steve for 25 years, covered him for the Wall Street Journal and Fortune magazine, had conversations with him all the time that weren't even related to stories. Steve used to introduce people to Brent as his friend. And they had a close relationship within the boundaries of a journalist-source relationship. And Brent felt that Steve had changed more than any other business person he'd ever covered, and that change, that growth, both personal growth and growth as a business leader, had not been documented well. So we just felt that because of Brent's 25 years, we would have a different perspective to offer.
Give us a sense of your own perception of Steve Jobs going into this project.
It was interesting because I had always been a Mac user. I've been covering technology for years and years, and I was Brent's editor at Fortune on many of his cover stories about Apple. So I'd always wrestled with the difference between the Steve that Brent would talk about and the stereotypes of Jobs. And I was also deeply impressed with what Apple had done. And for me, when you compare Apple products to what comes out of the rest of the technology and computer business, there's no comparison. So I went in admiring Jobs, but not knowing a whole lot about who the person was. And I remember being just astounded in the first couple of interviews that we had, which were with people who Steve had fired or who had left either Next or Apple under difficult circumstances, how much they admired him despite that. And a couple of them cried as we were talking about him because it was about a year after he died, and that was still raw. And so I began to understand that there was a side of him that created real warmth and that there was real admiration and emotional attachment to the man. And that was very different from what I had expected. I had more or less expected that people tolerated him because he was a genius.
And at times in his life, that was absolutely true, too.
Oh, and it was true even for these people who felt, you know, so close to him. I mean, Steve could be a hellish person to work for. There were two kinds of people who really, you know, did not work well with Steve. One is people who didn't know what they were talking about or weren't prepared for their meetings with him, and he could eviscerate those people. You know, the other kind of people who had a hard time with him were people who he just didn't know very well or who were in positions that were lower down at Apple, and he just couldn't be bothered often to behave considerately with those people, especially in a meeting. There are all sorts of tales of Steve, you know, having very nice conversations with people in the lunch line at Apple and things like that. But if you were in a meeting and you were responsible for something and he didn't know who you were, all he wanted was for you to contribute to the meeting. If you didn't, he couldn't be bothered.
Now, earlier you said even people who were fired by him or left under difficult circumstances still felt this attraction. What was it about him that, you know, I think 99% of us, if we're forced out of a job, we generally don't have positive feelings about the person that forced us out. What was different about him?
Well, I think we sometimes underestimate how important it is for all of us to feel pride in our work, right? I mean, you know the difference between when you've done a good interview or you've done a bad interview. You know, you feel it. Even these people who had been fired by Steve or who had left because they didn't get the job they wanted or they had nowhere to go, they felt they had done the best work of their life for this man. He was a great enabler of genius. He was that from the beginning of his life, and he eventually learned how to do that over the long haul. Another thing was that he was wicked smart, and as this woman, Susan Barnes, told us, you know, you really know the difference between when your boss gets what you're doing and doesn't get what you're doing. And Steve got it. Steve understood. And the third thing is that he could be truly charming and truly interested in your personal life and how you were feeling and things like that. And these people had all gotten to that point in their relationship with Steve where they talked about their personal lives and stuff like that. Well, so he was very tough, but he had this other side to him.
You know, the other thing that comes out of the book was that as long as you were sort of following on his path of where to take products, and especially in the first time when he was in Apple, you know, here he and Steve Wozniak, the book sort of alleges that, you know, Wozniak was really the technical genius behind the Apple II, but it was Steve sort of as a maestro, if you will, sort of cajoling, pleading, asking, being dictatorial, and getting a better product.
It's a great word. Brent likes to describe Jobs as an impresario. And, you know, if you think about that, that involves bringing together all kinds of people and all kinds of ideas and taking this concoction and mixing it into something new. You know, there are impresarios behind circuses and behind concerts and all these sorts of things. And that's what Steve would do. He had this wide peripheral vision. He was as much into the liberal arts as he was into technology and engineering. And he would bring all these ideas together, and he would just take things, how they all added up would result in something that took things one step farther than technology had taken them before. And then he had the showman side of him, and he could present these products in a way that, you know, was unmatched in the technology industry.
Well, getting back to Wozniak, though, here's his original partner. They build the Apple II. They build a successful startup, which, you know, that's bucking odds right there from the very beginning. And yet Wozniak is sort of, once the Apple II becomes successful, he's about refining it, making it better. And Jobs is like, okay, the Apple II is done. We've got to go on to the next platform, which would be Macintosh. And at that moment, it's like whatever Steve Wozniak had done for him in the past, because Wozniak was still focused on the past, he was out of the picture.
You're so right. That is true. That's what happened. And in fact, you know, Jobs was so immature and brash at that point that he disparaged people who continued to work on the Apple II. He wanted to make it seem as if, you know, all the smart kids were working on the Mac. And so he was disparaging this critical partner in his life. And it gets to the complexity of Steve Jobs in the sense that that was a really immature thing to do. But even later in his life, Jobs was always looking forward. And so if you were one of his top executives and you had done something really fabulous in the past, if you weren't staying on board, if you weren't continuing to produce at a high level, he would start to drift away from you and he wouldn't pay attention to you. And that's, there was, he had a remarkably stable executive team, but there was some transition around 2004, 2005, and that's what happened in those cases. There were incredibly talented people who he felt were not coming along for the ride into the future.
We always have to remember that Steve Jobs was incredibly young when he and Wozniak first built Apple. And, you know, like everybody in their 20s, they're brash. They think they know everything in the world. And it takes a while before you realize that, you know, maybe you're not the greatest genius in the room, even if you are.
Yeah, you know, that was one thing that Brent remarked on. Brent really felt is that, you know, when he met Jobs in 1986, you know, he got the sense, and other people around Jobs at the time confirmed this. You know, Steve thought he could do Brent's job better than Brent could do it. He thought he could do anything better than anybody, and he learned during the time that he was away from Apple that was not true. And he really learned that at Pixar, because at Pixar he was kept out of the process of developing movies. Ed Catmull is the president there, is such a strong leader that he just said, you know, you've got to stay out of it. If you get in there, you're such a strong presence that you will throw off the development process. And he kept him out of the room. So Jobs watched from a distance as John Lasseter and the animators around him created Toy Story, even though, you know, production was stopped once, even though they started out with different main characters, even though, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg from Disney was pushing them in a different direction, and yet they came out with something perfect. And it's from that experience that Steve, you know, learned, oh, okay, well, you know what? First of all, I can't do everything better than anybody else. And I have to give those people some rein. So when he comes back to Apple, especially if you were in a discipline that he acknowledged he knew little about or not enough about, he gave you free rein. So Tim Cook, you know, really ran the operations and ran the supply chain that was such a huge deal for Apple. And Fred Anderson really ran the finances. If you were in marketing and design, Steve was heavily involved and was all over you. But luckily, he had people even in those areas who were strong and really stood up to him.
Well, one of the things the book points out is how Steve Jobs matured from here being this wunderkind that starts Apple. You know, he's running Apple and literally alienates everyone at Apple to the point where he's forced out. He says, okay, I'll just build another computer company next, which was a disaster. What did he learn in this time that sort of helped him when Apple is literally on the ropes and he comes back in as CEO?
There are two critical things that come out of Next. One is that Steve failed there. He introduced a brand new computer. He introduced it late. It was too expensive. And the world yawned. The world didn't care. And it was a harsh lesson. And he wouldn't admit it at the time, and he was not a guy to look back and say, I learned that lesson. But he learned from that one product could not change the world anymore. That's because the computer industry had become so competitive. The other thing he learned was persistence, stick-to-itiveness. He stuck with Next until he could sell the thing to Apple. He was going to make something of it. And there was a persistence that he never had at Apple, you know, the first time around. He walked away from a couple of big projects. He just left because he was bored. You never saw that during the last 15 years of his life.
Well, you mentioned also when he was at Nexus, when he comes into contact with Pixar. And as you mentioned earlier, says this, he really learned a lot from the management of Pixar because he learned how to be a better leader of how to manage creativity in his own people as opposed to being the creative spark and dictatorial, just too much in the face to really have long-term success.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we spent a lot of time talking to Johnny Ive, the head of design at Apple, and that time was always a conversation. It was not Jobs dictating what Ive should do. It was a conversation where they'd go over things again and again and try to solve problems together. And Jobs had enormous faith in his own design ability and his own taste. But that relationship with Ive is sort of the height of a creative conversation, and it was ongoing over years and years. And the young Steve Jobs just did not work that way. He could do that for a while. He did it for a while with Wozniak. They collaborated. They would test ideas together. But it didn't happen much. And when he came back, he did it again and again. Avi Tavanian was a brilliant software guy who led a great team that designed the OS X operating system. And they did, you know, amazing work. And Steve would spend hours and hours going over the user interface with Avi and his team, and it was a conversation. And there could come a time, as there can with any boss, where he'd say, no, you're going to do it this way. But it was a real conversation. And being intensely involved with something is different from micromanaging in the bad sense. He could be a bad micromanager sometimes, but he was also deeply engaged in a conversation with his key employees, and they appreciated the intensity and the intelligence he brought to those conversations.
My guest today is Rick Tetzeli, executive editor of Fast Company. He and co-author Brent Schlender have written a new biography of Steve Jobs titled Becoming Steve Jobs. It's published by Crown Business, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. When he comes back to Apple, Apple is literally on the ropes, it seems like. And by this time, I'm sure you're covering business. What did you think of Steve Jobs coming back to Apple? Because I think the industry reaction and the business journalism reaction was, well, this will be the last nail in the coffin.
Yep, that's exactly it. I remember having conversations with Brent at the time, and you know, he said, well, you know, this is really their last hope, and I really thought, I said to him, you know, you're nuts. It is over. I mean, this guy's so undisciplined. I mean, we all knew he was so creative and everything, but when he took over Apple, I remember the only thing that was interesting about Apple at that time was who's going to buy it, or is it going to go bankrupt? That was it. You know, if you'd had to bet, you know, you would have bet that Apple wouldn't last 1 year. Bill Gates told us, he said, you know, the board of directors hands the job to Steve Jobs, and they're like, okay, well, that was our last hope. Let's see what happens now. And what happened, of course, was that he got rid of the whole board of directors, almost the whole board of directors. That was one of his first steps. So many of us business journalists were wrong. He did not come back and try to solve everything in one fell swoop. He was not undisciplined. And he moved in a step-by-step fashion. You know, people think Apple was saved by the iMac, and then it became a big deal because of the iPod. But in fact, it's a deeply complicated step-by-step process, and Jobs was patient. You know, the first thing he did was an advertising campaign, and it was directed mostly at the employees to get their pride up, to get them starting to think about being bold after years and years of creating products that, you know, were marketing-driven and that were not interesting. The second thing he did was he captured the public's imagination with the iMac, which was not a powerful machine.
This is the one with the colors, right?
It was had the colors.
Yeah,
it started
right.
out with the Bondi Blue, which was named, you know, for beach in Australia, and he captured our imagination with that. And then there was a marketing campaign featuring all those colors, and it was catchy, and it made you think, oh, something interesting is going on at Apple for the first time in a decade. It was really, and nobody could have predicted it. But he behaved with patience and determination, and that was the key.
Of course, the second stint at Apple is best known for, you know, these incredible gatherings where it was like, what is Steve Jobs going to introduce this time?
Yes.
And yet there's a picture in the book of the very first, one of the first one of these, and I think, and it's in, I think it's the first iPod, if I remember right. And it's in a small little auditorium there at Apple because they really had no sense of how this was going to go over.
They really didn't. They had never done a device like the iPod. They knew it had potential. They didn't understand its potential, actually. There were a couple of journalists who Steve invited over to Apple to sort of play with the iPod before it was released, and Brent was one of them, and they were sitting in a meeting, the two of them. It was just the two of them, and Brent still had his hearing at that point, and he loved music, and he was playing around with it, and he told Steve, he said, this shuffle thing is fantastic. It's like your own personal radio station. And Steve was like, huh, really? Because that was the part that he had not appreciated. And of course, shuffle was, in many ways, one of the things that people loved most about it. They initially called the iPod a peripheral, and peripherals are like hard disk drives or something like that, you know, usually. So their expectations were low.
Once the success of the iPod comes out, this utterly transforms the company. Doesn't it?
It transforms it completely. And it also, you know, it transforms it. The company starts moving on a much faster treadmill. Consumer electronics is different from computing in that you have to have new versions every year. You have to compete with other companies that are catching up to you quickly. You have to manufacture millions of devices a month instead of thousands of devices a month. And the execution behind Apple's success in the 2000s is truly astounding. And that's part of the reason that Tim Cook was a very natural choice to be Steve Jobs' successor, even though the two of them are completely different people, is that Cook proved himself as a master of complexity. He ran this massive supply chain. He oversaw the inventory. He could handle anything that Jobs threw at him. And in many ways, that's what Apple needs now. Apple now is twice as big as when Steve died. Mm. It's a really complicated company. And if they get into fashion and cars and, you know, now the watch, it will get more and more complicated.
To me, that's really sort of the genius of Jobs is he has a short attention span, which mm-hmm. was to the detriment of Apple in the days when you had the Apple II, and he says, okay, we need to build a whole new computer instead of mm-hmm. updating this. That sort of short attention span is exactly why Apple's able to constantly come up with new products. It's that meme, if you will.
Right. I think that it's, you know, you can call it a short attention span. You can call it also, you know, a continuing focus on the future. He was always about the future. There's one of the things that I loved about our interview with Johnny Ive is that he told us, you know, he said when you create a product, there are two things you create. You create the product itself, and you create everything, all the learning that you've gained during the creation of that product. And so even when Jobs would be up presenting, you know, the latest version of the iPod, or he'd be presenting the new version of an iPhone, in the background, they were already working on the next version. Even though Steve was up there proclaiming the virtues of the first iPhone, they were already busy working on the second version, and they'd found all these problems with the iPhone that they had created. It was really tremendous.
One last question. Towards the end of the book, you detail Jobs' valiant battle with his health over the last few years and still continuing running the company, even with a few leaves of absence, first pancreatic cancer and then liver cancer. And towards the end, Bill Gates, of course, Gates and Jobs had been bitter competitors at times, actually somewhat unfriendly at times, grudgingly respectful of each other at times. But towards the end, they seemed to have a respect. And Gates said something. He says, you know, when it comes to me or Steve Jobs, you know, we're going to get all the headlines, but it's a whole team of people working. And certainly in a complicated company, like whether it's Microsoft or Apple, there are a lot of people that are really making the products. But how much credit should go to Jobs, and how much is it to the team?
I think the team deserves more credit than it's gotten in the past. Jobs did not give the press access to the people on the team much, and the team was truly outstanding. It was a joint effort. I think it's also clear that Apple needed a central figure like Steve Jobs to be saved and to grow as it did, to become what it did. Now, however, it's something else, and Tim Cook is no Steve Jobs, and that's both a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, he may not be, you know, as he may not be sort of as creative as Steve Jobs, but he's an incredibly capable guy and really forward-thinking in his own way. So I think that, you know, Steve Jobs deserves enormous credit. But I also think Gates is right that we shouldn't write these histories as if, you know, all the creation was Steve's or all the creation was Gates's. There were many, many, many people who also deserve attention for their contributions. They needed a central figure to bring it all together. And that's who Steve Jobs was.
I think that's one of the things your book does. We get a sense of that.
Good. we hoped to give that sense.
The name of the book is Becoming Steve Jobs. Rick Tetzeli, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Rick Tetzeli is the executive editor of Fast Company and co-author, along with former Wall Street Journal and Fortune reporter Brett Schlinder, of the new biography, Becoming Steve Jobs. It's published by Crown Business. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.